Have you heard of the Plot Manuscript? It's 330 pages, an overview of the entire Bible. People who have read it have said it's helped them understand and enjoy the Word of God. Hi, this is Bob Enyar. I wrote the plot years ago. We sell it at a money-back guarantee, $49.95 plus shipping and handling. And if you don't feel that you really understand the Bible now, we want to give you your money back. So go online to order it at kgov.com or call us at 800-8-ENYAR. That's 1-800-836-9278. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyar, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. I've told you about the must-read true crime story by Lee Martin, 10 Minutes Till Midnight. In fact, you've heard Steve Curtis in studio, and this is about Denver's crime of the century, the murder of the century back in the 1980s, the Parkside Cafe. Well, from Atlanta, Georgia, Lee Martin, the author, is here. In studio, Lee, welcome to Bob Enyar Live.
Good morning, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lee, when you walked in today, the staff, everybody's around here has read this book cover to cover.
Yes.
They say they can't put it down. It is not only a true crime story, but then the courtroom drama is riveting. So could we talk through the book? I don't often interview authors, so it's fun for me to have the author of such a powerful book in studio. So let's talk through this book from your perspective, from the author's perspective.
Well, thank you, Bob. I wasn't really sure. I initially wanted to write this book because a friend of mine, Jim Anderson, he introduced me to Steve Curtis.
Jim Anderson is a friend of Bob Enyar Live. He and Steve Curtis co-founded LifeCommercials.com, which is a significant ministry reaching young women at that point where they're thinking about having an abortion. They do a tremendous job on the internet and with TV commercials. Their specialty is producing TV commercials.
Oh, absolutely. And Jim had come to Atlanta to do a luncheon, a benefit on lifecommercials.com and brought Steve with him. Mm. So Jim said, "I'd like you to meet this guy because he has a compelling story he wants to tell." And he says, "He's told that to me many times, and you've written 4 novels and..."
Lee, you have written, as you just said, 4 novels. Some of those titles, The 6 Mile Inn and Wolf Laurel, those were novels. This is your first nonfiction book?
That's correct. Yeah, those were all fiction, except the second book, The 6 Mile Inn, was a fictionalized account of a true series of events that happened about 200 years ago.
Mm. Whereas this book, there's a lot of dialogue in this book, 10 Minutes Till Midnight, Steve Curtis' story, and that dialogue is not fictional. You went to great pains, as we'll get into, to get the story straight from thousands of pages of transcripts.
That's correct.
In interviews with Steve Curtis. But so Jim Anderson had gone down for a Life Commercials presentation, and you met Steve Curtis on that trip?
I did, and I went to dinner with Steve, with my wife, Sandy. He sat there and across the table in about 45 minutes gave me a capsule of what had happened in 1989. And, of course, this started out in 1988 when a friend of Steve's that actually lived in a house with Steve, mm-hmm, Curtis, witnessed a robbery. He was actually a victim to a robbery at the Parkside Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
In 1988. So, a year later...
And that was an armed robbery.
An armed robbery.
Of course, it made the news, and it was botched, and which is good. And so, one of the guys was caught, and that's what set up the story.
Exactly. And this, the guy that was caught was I guess you would call him a Crip kingpin. And the worst of an antisocial personality.
Mm.
And...
criminal...
Criminal mind.
Yeah, and seemingly without morals, just a real bad guy.
Yeah, actually, later on, when the case was prosecuted, the prosecutor or the assistant district attorney said, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, I'm going to introduce you to a criminal culture. Mm-hmm. And that's what he called it, a criminal culture.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Steve was telling me this story, and I was just sitting there just mesmerized. And so Jim said to Steve, well, this is a guy that ought to write this book. You've been wanting to get it out. And Steve had read my other books, and he says, well, you know, I do like the way you write mm-hmm. and the way you describe things. So mm-hmm. is it possible that you could do this? And I said, well, I really don't know. I'd have to think about it. I've never written anything nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So I went another complete year without seriously considering it. And then I came out to Denver and communed with Steve and Jim, and we actually went down to Bonnie Bray. We actually went down to Bonnie Bray to the house where the murders took place. That's what I try to do, is I try to put myself in that very scenario.
And that house, in fact, Lee, you mentioned an interesting historical footnote with that house. I've been on radio in Denver for 18 years, 5 days a week, but I'm a newcomer to the business. That house has a place in the history of Denver radio broadcasting.
Oh, that's correct. As I understand it from Steve, when he bought the house, he understood that the first radio station, the first talk radio station, was broadcast from there. And when you see the house, you think, oh, it's just a common little old house, you
yeah,
know?
Right,
and,
right.
And how could that be? But that would have been back closer to the 1920s, from what I understand.
Wow, wow. So that's the Bonnie Bray district
of
Denver. So you went there with Steve, and I've never done that. Steve and I have been friends for many years, but I've never gone back there with Steve to, you know, have him tell me the story right there.
Well, you know, it's like stepping back into history. I think it was somewhere around the 16-year level after this took place. I'm sort of a history buff anyway, and so when I go and visit Civil War parks and things like that, you know, I can imagine what transpired there. And so we walked down the back alley where the killers actually drove up and came into the back of the house, went down in the basement, and lay wasted. They waited for Steve and who they thought was Frank Magnuson to come home.
Mm.
And Frank wasn't with them. It was Steve and a fellow named Dan Smith, and they were all friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they socialized together, and they prayed together, and they were really good friends. And so that's when it happened, and it was a heinous crime. And you wonder what makes this any different from any other murder scenario, because you know, in other scenarios, more people can be killed.
Mm-hmm.
It can be more egregious. It could be a type of murder that is so sensational that, you know, it hits the national news and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it hit the Denver news, and it was compelling to the Denver people.
It was called by the judge in the case, and the media would occasionally refer to this as perhaps Denver's crime of the century, because there was an armed robbery, and then there were witnesses, and then there was a hit ordered from behind bars, and
yes,
multiple murder. And the drama in the courtroom was so dramatic and so absurd in exposing the brokenness, I think, of our criminal justice system, that it would take so long to accomplish something that should have been so obvious and so simple and straightforward. And then through all that, we were at a time in our history where the murder epidemic in America was exploding onto the scene.
That's correct.
Became a time of just uncontrollable gang activity and murder, so that we would talk about the murder capitals of the country. And was it New Orleans or Washington, D.C. or New York City? And Denver's had this horrendous summer of crime that you write about in your book during part of the trial. It was a key moment in the tragic history of crime in our state of Colorado.
Yes. Well, one thing I did want to convey as well, you know, unfortunately, the people who lose their lives, who get murdered, are kind of lost in all this. You know, when I'm doing all the research, and I came here twice, and I interviewed people. I interviewed Larry and Jackie Magnuson about their son, and of course Steve, and a couple of other folks. And you know, I wanted to get to know. I wanted to get inside the heads of the characters that I was writing about to build the story in regards to the murder case. I had to do that. Now, the second part of the book covers the trial. And Jim Anderson, as you mentioned, he secured for me court transcripts, 28,000 pages that I read over a period of about a year.
Wow.
And that was before, and actually all I did was just take notes and take note after note.
Wow.
And I write on legal pads, by the way, and I write, I don't write in sometimes in full sentences. It's just excerpts and words here and there. And I say, well, does this word fit? And so on. So that's what I did. I reviewed the court transcripts. And so
28,000 pages of documents. That's boxes and boxes.
Well, fortunately, Jim had secured a CD.
Oh.
I think when he went to see what they had in the storage area, there were boxes and boxes and boxes of transcripts. Well,
they had scanned it.
They had scanned it, and it was all on this CD. So I kept notes on everything, and, of course, I wanted the book to be as accurate as I could possibly get it. And Steve and I worked on this diligently. So that I knew what transpired was accurate. And, of course, I got a lot of information out of the court transcripts about what had happened. So that was...
So there were the interviews with Steve, and there were multiple interviews, both in Atlanta and then here in Colorado, and then the transcripts. And so you would go back to Steve, and it seemed to me, from what I understand, that you sort of would grill him. And you say, Steve, I want this as accurate as we can possibly get it.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, this actually happened 20 years ago this past June. The murders actually took place 20 years ago. And so at the 17-year level when I am developing the book, he didn't have a lot of recall, except that when I did start grilling him on things, he says, you know, now I remember this. It's all coming back to me.
Yeah, it's the way our memories work, and you're in the transcript. So Steve is now reliving it through your research, and that's the way our brains work. Our brains remember these things, and we have pathways to get to those memories, and they start to get unused, and it's like we forget how to find a cafe in Venice somewhere, you know? And then you start walking around the city, and then you say, oh, yeah, I remember. It's down that alley back there.
Exactly, and there's a spark or a catalyst, you know, that pops into – to Steve's mind when I mentioned something. He said, either I didn't remember that, but now it's all coming clear, or did that really happen? Because, you see, he didn't sit in the courtroom all during there were two trials. You know, it was the first trial, which ended in a mistrial, and the second trial.
And this is of Kevin Fears.
This is the one of Kevin Fears. This is the guy, this is the trigger man who actually killed Frank Magnuson and Dan Smith. And speaking of Frank, if I may, you know, like I said before, sometimes people who are murdered, they get lost in all this because they're not living anymore for them to tell the story. Exactly, for all the dialogue that's out there. And Frank was a hero. And he had an entire year from, I think, September of 1988 until June of 1999. So just less than a year to think about what he was going to do. He was going to testify against Denver's worst people. And so
he could have backed out. He could have said no. He knew there were threats. There were phone calls coming to the house. They found out where they lived, what their phone number was. And he had the courage to go forward and do what was right.
He knew that was going on, and he knew the person who was calling the house was connected with the Young brothers, who, and of course, Roy or Roger Young, his real name is Roger.
And his brother Joe.
His brother Joe. And Joe was with Kevin Fears when the murders took place. Mm-hmm. And so Frank knew about all this. And anyway, he said, you know, I'm going to testify. I'm going to do this. I'm going to step up because I want my dad, my mom to be proud of me.
Mm. Okay. And Lee, he also, I think, as I read your book, even at the Parkside Cafe robbery, I thought he came across with courage and a hero there. Some people might interpret the events differently, but there's this armed robbery, and it was four guys, and a gun was pulled, and it was Frank Magnuson and this girl, Cheryl Kai, who worked at the Parkside, and Frank took off running, which was absolutely perfect. He ran across the street into the park, and for one, he could have been shot in the back.
Yes.
But he's not going to be able to help Cheryl there. So he needs to get help. He took off running, and two of the four went after him.
Exactly. And I think what he was trying to do, and we don't know, but he was trying to draw them away from her.
Yeah, exactly. And that worked. And then he ended up in a scuffle fighting those guys.
He did. He actually went behind a tree and waited for them to come by, and he tripped one of them, jumped on him, and they were actually, he and I believe it was Joe Young, three of the four players in the murders were Roger, Joe Young, and Kevin Fears. Mm-hmm. And then there was a fourth man.
Mm-hmm.
And
the fourth man later turned himself in when the crime became so high profile, and
yes,
he turned state's evidence.
He did turn state's evidence. And, of course, his story was the defense attorney who was named Sunwolf. She tried to discredit this other person who was involved in the Parkside robbery by saying, hey, you just want to get a plea bargain so that the number of years that you're serving can come down.
Mm-hmm.
The defense attorneys tried every way in the world to discredit every witness, mm-hmm, that including Steve.
Did he have a deal, that fourth guy at the Parkside Cafe? Do you recall if the prosecutors gave him a deal?
I don't think they actually gave him a deal. They said they would move him because he would be chopped liver, actually.
Yeah, he'd be
where he was.
Right. His life would be at risk.
Exactly.
We're talking about Frank being a hero. So he pulled off two guys, and then there were neighbors who were able to come to Cheryl's rescue. So instead of four guys, some or all with guns, who knows, he split the force in two, in half.
Exactly.
And there were two guys, and of course it was foiled. And if he had not done what he did, it might have been two dead victims inside the Parkside Cafe.
Most definitely.
So Frank was a hero, I think, in both ways, during the crime and then his courage to testify afterward.
And that heroism was recognized by the mayor, and I believe his name is Peña.
Mayor Federico Peña back then, yeah.
Yes, back then. Recognized at Frank's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a representative there to read a very, very profound statement, mm-hmm, about Frank.
That's right. And then we were also talking about Steve not being in the courtroom. As I read the book, you know, Steve then worked with you on the book. He had read the book before I did,
yes,
then the completed version. But up until that, I would have known the story of those trials better than he did because, as you were about to point out, he spent months where he could not be in the courtroom because of our system.
Yes.
Only when he was testifying was he in the courtroom. So he would spend weeks in a witness waiting room waiting to take the stand.
Or he would not, exactly, but in most days, he was not even there. He was not even
right
in sight.
Right. He would stay weeks, and they'd tell him, we need you, and day after day would become weeks that he'd be just waiting to take the stand. And so the insanity, he would have to hear about it secondhand, compared to the people who were there in the courtroom. And you mentioned this defense attorney who changed her name during these proceedings. I think her name was Hotez.
Linda Hotez. Right.
Okay. And she changed it to Sunwolf.
Yes.
And she wears a monkey paw around her neck, a necklace.
Yes.
Throughout the trial. And she's just the classical, in my worldview, the insane liberal. She's just a lunatic. And she's undermining morality in our criminal justice system.
And she tried to convey, as she was grilling Steve, she wanted to on one side be empathic and say, "Gee, what you went through, I just can't believe what
we're
the,
so
the faith
sorry
and their courage and everything." Right. Okay, but then on the other hand, she tried to discredit him, and especially trying to discredit Frank Magnuson, mm-hmm. who wasn't there to defend himself.
Yeah, she objected to a picture of Frank with his family.
Exactly.
She just objected to that. But then when Kevin Fears, when it's time for the sentencing, she wants a picture of the murderer with his family.
Well, and also, and as a little boy looking like a choir boy, you know, with a bow tie and everything, and look how innocent this child is, and
right.
look at all the problems that he had. In his family, mm-hmm. and he had some mental impairments and so on. Mm. And it was really a sell she was trying to do to the jury that just didn't come across. And mm-hmm. and then we know what happened at the end of the trial.
Yeah, that Kevin Fears was convicted. And you know what I enjoyed, Lee? A historian, and like you said, one of your novels is a fictionalized account of a historical event.
Yes, sir.
An author of a true crime story is like a historian in that you take 28,000 pages of documents and you take interviews and you have to boil it down to what's significant. Well, you put something in your book that I'm so thrilled it's there because it's so revealing. The defense team, I think they're just atrocious in their behavior, just immoral, they're culpable. They do what they can to destroy justice. Lawyers are experts in the circumvention of the law, and this book shows that perfectly. Well, they will defend their client, Kevin Fears, for any grotesque murder, for the most absurd claims, the most cruel accusations against the victims. And yet at the very end of it, he stands up and tells the judge that he thinks that they did a poor job representing him, and within a heartbeat, they turn on him, their own client, they turn on him to defend themselves, these hypocrites. Their self-interest is all that they care about.
They were flabbergasted when he said that. Their mouths were agape, and exactly, they did turn on their own client and say, "Well, Judge, you know, we did the best job we possibly could, and we don't understand why this is going on."
Right, right. They believe anything he could say about murder.
Right.
But one meek little statement that I don't think they did a very good job, and all of a sudden he's the bad guy.
He is the bad guy.
And they'll go after him.
Yes.
So, Lee, it's an honor to have you here in the studio and to have you out in Colorado from Atlanta, Georgia. I hope you're enjoying the state of Colorado.
Well, I certainly am, and it's an honor to be here, and I've looked forward to this, and I look forward to meeting you. I hadn't met you before.
Well, thank you, Lee. I've been looking forward to it also. Jim Anderson set this up for us. And in fact, I was just at the sand dunes with my son's Boy Scout troop, and I know you've been through the mountains with Jim Anderson. So welcome to the state of Colorado. This book and your novels, people could find out about your writings at your website, leemartinbooks.com.
That's correct.
So it's Lee Martin, L-E-E, Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, books.com. And Lee, I want to thank you for writing this. This is a must-read true crime story that then takes you through the courtroom drama, and it teaches us a lot about human nature, about our criminal justice system, what is broken, and what we need to do, if we can, to influence for good, for what is right, the way our system works.
Thank you, Bob, and it was a privilege to be here with you.
All right. Lee, it's great to have you on the show. So this This book is part of our effort to teach people about right and wrong. Right and wrong. Why is there such a thing as right and wrong? At Bob and Yart Live, our themes, there is a God. There is a God who made us, and we have the right to life because he created us in his image and his likeness. At the sand dunes this past weekend with my son and his Boy Scout troop, you know, there was a bug, and one of the kids stepped on a bug. And so there was a discussion. Is it okay to kill a bug? And we talked about a bug is not made in God's image and likeness. It is okay to kill a bug. But a human being, that is why murder is wrong. We are endowed by our Creator with the right to life. He said that it is wrong to shed innocent blood. God said that. And so that's the foundation of not only a criminal justice system, but it's the foundation of governance, of civilization, being civil to one another. And it's also the foundation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because when we do wrong, when we rebel against God, there's this terrible separation. And Jesus Christ came to die for our sins. In fact, he experienced the death penalty for us so that we could live forever if we trust in him. So, you know, there are liberals who are against the death penalty, but actually the death penalty is at the heart of the gospel of Jesus Christ. If there was something fundamentally immoral or wrong with killing someone, then when liberals get Christians to believe that, you know what happens? They begin to undermine the gospel of Jesus Christ, because God the Father required the death penalty, the crucifixion of his own son, so that he could provide eternal life for us. So stand up for the death penalty. You could Google God death penalty, read about it. And this book, Lee Martin, 10 Minutes Till Midnight. Hi, this is Bob Benyard. If you'd like to hear more, then tune in weekdays at 3 right here on KLTT for Bob Benyard Live. Also, you could subscribe to our Bob and Yart Live Bible studies, our monthly videos, our sermons. For the Bible studies, you get an entire album on audio tape or MP3 CD for $34.95 a month. Or you could get our videos or sermons every month mailed to you for just $24.95 a month. To subscribe, please call 800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. That's 800-836-9278, or you could subscribe online at kgov.com. Also, Denver Bible Church, you're invited Sunday morning or evening for Bible study, worship, and fellowship. We have such a great time together, so come on out or check us out on the web at kgov.com for Bob and Yart Live.